Hello, everyone. We welcome you to our Saturday morning Bible study. We're so glad you could join us. Today, we're recording from the North Star Cottage on a beautiful November morning, and we welcome you all. And Tom is here today, yay, so he will start off.
Yay, happy to be here. Welcome, everyone. Okay, so we'll start out with our hymn. I praise thee, Lord, for blessing sent, to break the dream of human power. For now my shallow cistern spent, I find thy font and thirst no more. I take thy hand and fears grow still. Behold thy face and doubts remove. Who would not yield his wavering will to perfect truth and bound with love? That truth gives promise of a dawn, beneath whose light I am to see, when all these blinding veils are drawn, thy love has always guided me. So this is hymn 138, the words written by Samuel Johnson.
Beautiful and beautifully read, Tom. Beautiful hymn. Yeah. Comments on that?
Yes, I would like to add that you can tell by this poem that he had such a deep, abiding love for God, and that he really couldn't do anything without him. And he did a lot of stuff. He's quite the writer in his time. I was very impressed with the things I found out about him.
Mm-hmm. I found a lot about him too on hymn 37 that he wrote. And if we are there, I'll tell you what I found. Unless you want to wait to get there.
Well, does anyone have anything to say about the hymn itself?
Oh, there's so many wonderful things in here. I'm hoping everybody would jump in. I mean, I love the first sentence. That's the main reason I picked it. I mean, I praise thee, Lord, for a blessing sent. I mean, the sense of gratitude, like, it's got to be foremost in our life, right? To be very thankful. And then, you know, it ends with kind of the realization when all these blinding veils are drawn. Thy love has always guided me, you know, saying that God has always been there, always present, never gone, you know?
Thank you.
Beautiful. Break the dream. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Break the dream of the human power. It's just so, you know, that's what we're, you know, our goal is to realize that we're not here in matter, and to break that dream of power. It's wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a strong man that needs to be bound, this dream of human power. And yes, shallow cistern spent, when we've tried everything and it's all empty and nothing, and we're so miserable, until we find thy fount and thirst no more. We find
I love that. Yeah.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear. He had a very pure heart. Otherwise, these words would not have come.
I love where he says, I take thy hand and tears grow still. Beautiful to me.
Yes.
Beautiful. Oh, and the next line, too. Just same thought, right? Behold thy face and doubts remove.
Yeah.
This whole thing about taking God's hand and beholding his face, you know, and we're calm, right? This is actually probably the main reason I picked this hymn. But the calmness that we realize when we're in, you know, when we turn to God, right? Not to be so anxious and rubbing our hands, so to speak, a visual, like, you know, I'm so worried, you rub your hands and everything. But no, we're happy and we're content because God is present.
I think that's such a comforting thing, really. Because I know that's what helped me when I was so afraid. I would walk and just keep knowing that my hand is in your hand. And it brought such comfort. And really, that's how I got through. My hand is in my
hand. It kind of shows what is our part in the deal. We have to take his hand. We have to reach out and then God does the rest.
Yeah. The line, to break the dream of human power, made me think of his free thinking and his kind of rejecting the dogma in the church. And he ended up forming a free church in Lynn, Massachusetts, and was pastor from 1853 to 1870. It was transcendentalism and things in the free thought of that day that he was just alight with, and he was just full of the love of God.
And we know who else was in Lynn at that time as well.
Yeah.
So feel free to continue with comments on the hymn and also on question number one. What do we know about Samuel Johnson? So if people have other thoughts they want to tell us about Samuel Johnson, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, he was born in Salem, Massachusetts. 1822.
Why is that? His mother wasn't a witch.
And he went to Harvard. He was a Harvard graduate, Harvard educated, and he became a minister without any ordination. That's interesting.
Yes.
And he also, Longfellow, who we also have hints from him, described him as having absolute faith in the divine. And also they say his life was so much marked of brotherhood that they called him the universal friend, which I think is also so beautiful. He's just a great man. Wanted free thought, you know, people not to be constrained with creeds and so on. And that's why he was trying to established a free church in Lynn, Massachusetts.
Thank you. Yes, definitely contemporary of Rossetti. There were a lot of great thinkers at that time, and in New England particularly. It's quite interesting. The thought was rising. And I looked up transcendentalism. I didn't really know what that was. I didn't write the definition down, but it said seeing the good in people.
Oh.
It was also, you know, anti-slavery, pro-woman's rights. It was very
progressive.
Progressive, yes.
In the right sense of the word.
In the right sense of the word. Doing a lot of good. And that's what he was. And someone, I got a quote, someone said about him, a friend, the feeling he always gave me, writes a friend, in listening to his prayers, was of one in reality holding converse with God himself. So when he said his prayers, it seemed like he was talking to God himself. And I'm sure he was.
Yeah, breaking away from creeds and dogmas and the oppressive rules of the established church to the honestly recognize that God is natural good. And he's beautiful and he's good. And it resonated with the people. They loved him. And he preached for quite a long time. And one of the things that he is quoted from him is he said, I have taught natural religion, its intimations of God and beauty and immortality, the strength, sweetness of its life in God. Its gospel of the soul's essential relations to eternal rectitude, its hold on the everlasting through noble uses of nature and life, its root in present deity. So this is a man actually very close to God. Yeah. And close to the fact of God's relationship with man being one of good, as opposed to the sternness of the established religion.
Yeah, he said transcendentalism, going more with your intuition than what people were telling you, which is, you know, good.
Yeah, Mrs. Eddy refers to a spiritual sense.
Yes, yes. Go ahead, Florence.
No, I said it's really great because God is talking to everyone anyway, so that has to be respected.
Exactly, that's right. It has to be respected.
Well, and I think it's indicative of the fact that there were, you know, there were quite a few people, as Mary said, in New England, especially, who were receptive to the new yet old, as Mrs. Eddy refers to it, science of Christianity, who were, you know, ready to rise above you know, the established beliefs, and you know, the science of Christianity, the timing was right. I mean, God knew what he was doing and where, you know, because it had to be established in a place like New England in order to survive. Think anywhere else in the world, it would have been, you know, beaten down and opposed so badly that it, you know, it wouldn't have survived. But it was the right place at the right time for the establishment of Christian science.
Yeah, because that's what was percolating there, mm-hmm. was that. And thank you so much. That was such a beautiful hymn, Tom, and the way you read it and spoke to it was very, very touching and true.
Oh, thank you. So I just want to add about really about our library, right? So this is how we can utilize our online catalog, because as most of you know, not everybody, but we are developing an online catalog for our Christian Science publications. So here we can add in books written by Samuel Johnson and put a card in our online catalog. So if anybody wanted to read more about Samuel Johnson, things he wrote, you know, our catalog should help them, right? So his book that he wrote, his masterpiece, is 800 pages.
Ooh.
So, And Wikipedia, and seem to be some nice reviews about it, but not Christian Science. But you know, he was selected for one of the hymns in the Christian Science hymnal, and I think someone else mentioned there's another one by him.
Yes,
mm-hmm. So
and a third as well.
Did he?
And a third. Wonderful. Three hymns by this guy. That's pretty amazing.
Yes, hymns of the Spirit.
Where his thought was, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so I guess we'll move into our Bible study. Our topic is lift up your hands and bless the Lord, which comes from Psalm 134, verse 2. So the questions, and we're skipping question one because we effectively talked about Samuel Johnson, but the next three questions comes from the Songs of Ascent, which we went through in the last Bible study. These are the 15 psalms that people recited on their journeys to Jerusalem, generally for a major feast. And they're all very short. I think one is kind of medium-sized, but very short psalms. And they have some really nice messages. So we'll go through some of them. So in question number two, can you do the right thing without God and make it work? So this is coming from Psalm 127, verses 1 and 2.
Which Bruce will read for us.
Thank you.
Psalm 127.
except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. For so he giveth his beloved sleep.
Thank you. Okay.
So after hearing that, can we do the right thing without God and make it work?
No.
No. Yes. You see it all around us. It might what?
Well, and it's kind of an ironic question in the first place. Can anything be the right thing without God? Before you question whether it can work or not, right?
Right.
Can anything be right without being based on principle? Can anything be right without being truthful? Can anything be right without being without the motive being divine love? So without God, the thing isn't right in the first place, right?
Right.
And, you know, sometimes we seem to see, and I hear people talk about it, where, oh, look at them. Look how they're prospering.
Yes.
Now, if there's no God in it, eventually it will fail. So you just should mind your own P's and Q's when it comes to that, because a lot of that is spoken out of envy and jealousy. And, you know, look at me. I'm a Christian Scientist. Why isn't my life better? Or I'm having to pray so much, or whatever people think. But wrong question, wrong thought. We don't know what's behind things. And as I said, if it's wrong, it will eventually fail. It will. It has to have God.
Yeah. And that appearance is just a judgment based on the surface appearance of
things. Absolutely.
Right.
Because if it's not wrong, inside there is turmoil. And the turmoil is the divine requirement that things be made right.
Yes.
And I'll leave anybody with the impression that you should just sit at home and do nothing. So obviously there is a motivation and a method of doing things the right way. So hopefully we can get into that discussion. Well, and this is why Mrs. Eddy states in our textbook that Christian Science helps, for example, businessmen be better businessmen, right? Mm-hmm. Because they can discern the thought and the purpose behind activities and be able to determine whether it's based correctly on God, on principle, or not. And that will determine whether it will succeed or whether it will fail. And in every walk of life, our spiritual sense will guide us as to whether, you know, the house is being built by the Lord or not, whether people are laboring, you know, according to God's purpose or not, or in vain, whether to be impressed by someone who gets up early and works late, whether God's providing them with, you know, the right things to do and the right sleep and that so forth. So,
go ahead, Jeremy.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, quite unknowingly, I made a very detailed case study in my in my human history. I tried to be a good guy. I tried to do the right thing. And it led me right into hell. So that's my answer.
Yeah. Yeah, because you see, he's talking about human goodness versus listening to God and having God use you. Divine goodness. And there's a big difference, because I tried that too. I tried really, really hard. And the word try, which is a word I don't like. In this case, I was trying, and trying implies perhaps failure. And yes, I repeatedly fell on my face, and I couldn't sustain it. Now, Carrie sent me some really beautiful things on these topics, which I'm going to share. The first is called Labor of Love by William McCracken. And he writes, the reward of labor corresponds to the quality of labor. If the sowing of the seed has been a labor of love, the harvest will satisfy abundantly. If the builder communes with God when he lays the foundations of the house, his labor of love will withstand the attempts of hate or jealousy to undermine it. As the psalmist sang, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. The sentinel who does not love the army of truth and liberty may go to sleep at his post. The merchant who dislikes or mistakes his vocation fails to serve his customers properly. The housekeeper who cannot make of her occupation a labor of love cannot make a happy home for others. So the child who cannot be interested in schoolwork wishes to play truant in order to find something he can enjoy. The fruit tree yields fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself. In human experiences, seeds of fear, envy, self-pity, revenge produce bitter fruit and sour grapes. But in the absolute science of real being, the seed is of good quality only, and the fruit is therefore good. So he's just bringing out your motive. What is your motive? If your motive is pure and right, and when you're humanly good, you're usually trying again that word, but have people like you. So your motive really isn't pure, and it won't stand the test of time. You might struggle along. When you have this divine motive, love is impelling you, nothing will stop you. You will leap over walls, as the Bible says. There's no stopping it when love, with a capital L, is behind what you do.
This is really true, what you're saying. This is what I was working with today, and something led me to go to come home and marry me. And I guess it was to hear this in the group about this false sense of human goodness, because that keeps tripping me all the time.
It's a big, you're not the only one. So.
And well, isn't there something Mrs. Eddy said about, and I paraphrase, merely moving around doesn't mean something gets done?
Yes, running around and accomplishing
nothing.
Yes, exactly. And she says, I believe it's either her or Martha Wilcox, says whatever we do should be of good, excellent, good quality. Nothing slovenly, but good, excellent. Whether we're in business, yes, cooking a meal, whatever we do should be of the highest standard and quality. Because why? Not because we're trying to impress anyone, because it's love for whoever you're serving. And, you know, Mrs. Eddy, she knew, right? She knew in her home when a meal was prepared out of love or whether it was prepared out of fear of making a mistake or just out of a sense of duty. And she would often reject meals because they weren't cooked with love.
I feel like if you do everything with the thought of glorifying God, I think that's what brings along the love. You do it why? Because you want to glorify God.
Thank you. That is so true. And that movie, you know, Chariots of Fire, those of you who have seen it, it's a beautiful movie where this two runners, and one was doing it to glorify God, and he refused to practice on the Sabbath days. He refused to give up his Sundays to do what everyone else was doing, and he ended up with a glorious victory, while the other one, in comparison, was all about him, me, myself, and I. And even though he was a very good runner, he ended up failing for the glory of God. And that's what he would say. He was doing it for God's glory.
Well, I give example in my work life how difficult this is, because where I work in banking, you know, the hours are kind of extraordinary. And I noticed a few, only a few, but very senior people who were very religious, not Christian Scientists, but they didn't work on Sunday. And there were other things they did. And so they always took time out for church or prayer, or I know one senior person, he was a member of his church choir. He sang a lot and had to practice in the evenings and things like that. So I always marveled at people in a very stressful environment, yet they took God first and they just adjusted their life around God. When most of us really couldn't do that because the pressures were kind of intense.
Thank you. That was one thing, you know, Mrs. Evans here in this church, she insisted upon. You didn't take a job. If you couldn't come to church on Wednesdays and Sundays and be at your post, then that job wasn't the right one for you. She made it an absolute priority. And so for those few of us left here in Plainfield, that's partly why you see what you see. We never miss a service. We don't miss anything. It is a way of life for us. We couldn't do otherwise. But she instilled that in us. And if you had some big, great job opportunity on the West Coast, well, you didn't accept it. You stayed here. She said that was an attack on the family and on the church and on community. You stayed and you worked here at your post. And I know all of us here can say we never lacked. We were never without. We always had everything we need. Is that not true?
It is true.
And then some. But this was a rule, a fast rule. And you see the churches closing and failing, and certainly I'm talking now Christian Science churches, and also the attack on children now on Sundays, all of this stuff that happens Sunday mornings. We used to have the blue law, and unfortunately that is no longer around, but you couldn't do any of that on Sunday. Now they have all kinds of events Sunday mornings. We ride through town, we see everyone having brunch, doing all kinds of things,
activities, playing right soccer. At church time. It's
right, and it's attack on this, and this was deeply instilled in us. So sometimes I have little patience for anything less, because if we could do it for how many years? 40 or more?
50.
Yep, then it's a standard to hold to. But again, everyone, I say this, but then you have to make your own choices and decisions about what and where you will be. And I always respect what anyone wants to do. But Tom brought it up, and here I am. So here we are.
Well, we're talking about things to help us in our lives. And I'll talk about one other thing. It's just saying a grace or a blessing before you eat food, because you know, and I'm just getting down to small things, right? It's not major, right? But if we think about it, I mean, the amount of attention that's placed on food for pleasure and taste, right?
Thank you.
And if we don't say our grace or blessing, we kind of lead down this path that we're eating food because it tastes good, because of the pleasure, and it's wonderful and so forth. And that diverts us away from God. And then if you think about the kind of foods you eat, I mean, chocolate cake and ice cream and so forth, then our health deteriorates, right? But if we step back and say a little blessing or grace or a sense of gratitude before we eat the food and realize that this food is not there for our pleasure, but it's for our sustenance from God, changes the whole way we go about our life.
Thank you. Very important. And Mrs. Eddy always said grace. She said it was instilled in her childhood, and she could not do otherwise. And she had that spoon made in commemoration, and she wanted people to buy it and use that spoon. And on that spoon, it said, what?
Not matter, but mind satisfies.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Bruce. Mm-hmm. There we go. We have that framed in the foyer of our church. And someone very lovingly sent one to me. So, but when they were first made in their sterling silver, she wanted everyone to have it as a reminder to do that. Because you're right. Health laws, all this stuff about food and weight and this and that, it's rampant in our world right now. And it is certainly a form of materialism.
And there's a lot of so-called food that is designed to be tasteful, but it's full of preservatives and other garbage and not really nutritional. And as a result, we have cases of obesity and health problems in our country than we have ever had.
Mm-hmm. And the purpose of that, like tobacco, was to get you addicted to it. Mm-hmm. So you like you couldn't do without it. It's a form of addiction. And
so before you eat something, ask yourself, did God send this to me? And if he did, then thank God for it.
Yeah. It's also designed to make you keep eating it. Like you just can't stop.
Yeah.
Addictive.
Yeah.
I think Mrs. Singletary shared a story, though, once of a families that could not afford anything different.
Well, that's
but because
true.
Of the love in the families and the, mm-hmm. the good quality, they were protected.
Yes, there is a very, and this wasn't Christian Science, but it was about, it was a poor family, I think, maybe in Mexico or something, and they couldn't afford very good food and they didn't eat very good food. But they were very healthy because they were happy, loving, God-fearing people. They loved their family. They loved their work. They were just good, good people. While on the other hand, there was this family where they worshiped all this food and exercise and making sure they ate every right thing and all of that. And they didn't do so well. So I won't say what happened to them, but let's just put it at that. So it's again, the motive. And if you can't afford the best food in the world, whatever you ate, Lord knows, I grew up on Wonder Bread and Kool-Aid and all kinds of stuff that's considered awful now. But that's what I ate as a child. That's what we had. Didn't do any harm. So, you know, whatever's your duty to do, you can do without harm to yourself. Thank you for that. Whoever brought it up. I guess you did, or Linda, thank you. There's a few things from Spurgeon. Now, I would suggest for all of you to look up these Psalms in Spurgeon, because he writes a lot, and I'll just share a little bit. But it's always good. You know, you feel like he's a Christian Scientist for the most
part. He was another contemporary.
Yes, he was another contemporary of Mrs. Eddy in England, Charles Spurgeon. And he says this Psalm 127, it says it's a song of degrees for Solomon. And the title probably indicates that David wrote it for his wise son, in whom he so greatly rejoiced. And what happened with Solomon? What was he doing? He was building a big house, right? A big temple.
Yes.
Yep. And as long as it was for the Lord, that was all right. But when it got where it wasn't, then it came down. Things got bad. And Spurgeon says, without God, we are nothing. Great houses have been erected by ambitious men, but like the baseless fabric of a vision, they have passed away. And also he talks about the watchman. And then he goes on to verse 2, which was very interesting, about in vain for you to rise up early to sit up late. And Spurgeon says, because the Lord is mainly to be rested in, care is mere vanity and vexation of spirit. We are bound to be diligent, for this the Lord blesses, but we ought not to be anxious. for that dishonors the Lord and can never secure his favor. And it goes on. Some deny themselves of needful rest because they have to toil all the time. But his point is, some of them, it's all because they have no faith in God and find no joy except in hoarding up the gold, which is their only trust. So he brings out the importance of sleeping well, which, yay for that. Let them take a fair measure of rest and a due portion of food, for it is their health. Of course, the true believer will never be lazy or extravagant. If he should be, he will have to suffer for it. And then, for he giveth his beloved sleep. Through faith, the Lord makes his chosen ones to rest in him in happy freedom from care. Those whom the Lord loves are delivered from the fret and fume of life and take a sweet repose upon the bosom of their Lord. He rests them, blesses them while resting, blesses them more in resting than others in their moiling and toiling. God is sure to give the best thing to his beloved, and we here see that he gives them sleep. That is laying aside of care or forgetfulness of need, a quiet leaving of matters with God. This kind of sleep is better than riches and honor. Note how Jesus slept amid the hurly-burly of a storm at sea. He knew that he was in his Father's hands, and therefore he was so quiet in spirit that the billows rocked him to sleep. It would be much oftener the same with us if we were more like him. I thought that was really beautiful. And something to think about. And Mrs. Eddy, I don't know, maybe it's in the blue book, but she said once she came into science, she slept like a baby. And she said if she had to get up and do something, she'd wake up, be alert, get it done, and then she'd go right back to sleep. Now, as one who's had sleeping problems and almost, you know, where you think it's a virtue where you're up toiling all night long, well, maybe not so. He giveth his beloved sleep, and we should have proper sleep as well as proper nutrition, food, from the Lord if it's based on God.
Spurgeon didn't have a very easy life, so he spoke from experience.
Yes, and for him to be able to sleep peacefully, which we all should have our periods of sleep.
Yeah, there is a rest for the people of God.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even if we have battles to battle every day, as long as we strive to defeat the enemy, we will be able to sleep well at night.
Yes.
We will have peace that we need.
It's only when you go to bed with unsolved issues. That's why before you go to bed, you go over your thought and make sure you've done everything you should and you're at peace with yourself and with God. It's very important. And then to count your blessings and be so grateful. And that ensures a good night's rest. And waking up in the morning, ready to go, ready to face the day, ready to do your work, ready to do your work for yourself, but also your world work, which is highly important.
Perhaps this is a segue into the next question.
Good. Tom?
Okay, so we go to question number 3. So can a person remain content both when life goes well and when it does not? This thought comes from Psalm 131, verses 1 to 3. And then related question, how does this kind of contentment relate to one who fears the Lord and walks in obedience? That thought comes from Psalm 128, verses 1 to 6.
Okay, Bruce?
Okay, Psalm 131. Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor mine eyes lofty. Neither do I exercise myself in great matters or in things too high for me. Surely I have behaved and quieted myself. as a child that is weaned of his mother. My soul is even as a weaned child. Let Israel hope in the Lord from henceforth and forever.
Thank you.
That's Psalm 131. Psalm 128. Blessed is everyone that feareth the Lord, that walketh in his ways. For thou shalt eat the labor of thine hands. Happy shalt thou be, and it shall be well with thee. Thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house. Thy children like olive plants round about thy table. Behold, that thus shall the man be blessed that feareth the Lord. The Lord shall bless thee out of Zion, and thou shalt see the good of Jerusalem all the days of thy life. Yea, thou shalt see thy children's children, and peace upon Israel.
Thank you.
So what's your attitude towards life when things aren't going well? Do you complain and grumble and moan and ask God why he did all these bad things?
No, we say thanks for the opportunity to learn.
Yes, exactly. Because if you take the adversity correctly, you will go up in the scale of being and be better for it.
I've heard inspired people thanking God for what might be called the bad times, but instead calling them the times that draw them closer to God. So if it appears bad, it's actually a tool for God. Because there's a lesson to be learned here, an upward trend.
Who was trying to speak?
What does Mrs. Eddy say about this?
Okay, go ahead.
Who's trying to speak?
Oh, I wanted to say the same as Bruce, like that it's sent for us to learn something and to go higher. And it's a good opportunity.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
I also think that, Paul's example is so beautiful for all of us. And where he says that, therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. I think he really is showing us. He said that thorn in the flesh kept him humble going forward, doing God's work. So it's not only when things are going right should we be happy or content. I think he has a good example for us. He is a good example.
Thank you.
Yeah, really. Go ahead.
This question made me think of the audio that we have on the website of the slaves in the sorrow songs. And they were always able to say, it is well with my soul. They had such trust and faith in God.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Beautiful song.
Yeah, any situation that forces us to get closer to God is a blessing, right? And what is it? She said, trials or what?
Proofs of God of fear.
So, when bad things happen, it's, the important thing is our attitude. I mean, we can see it as a really bad thing and wallow in the mud and be really unhappy, or we can see it as an opportunity to get closer to God and defeat the enemy.
I think also hymn 290, I believe, where it says that treading temptations down. I think treading the temptations down means you're going onward and upward. So, you know, no matter what happens, it helps us to see it as, you know, this, yeah, here comes another temptation, you know, and treading it down, I go upward and forward.
Thank you.
Yeah. And how many times does Mrs. Eddy refer to Christianity as warfare?
With oneself.
I mean, we've got some hymns about this, don't we? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are we worthy warriors?
Yeah, it gives, you know, if you love God and revere Him, fear Him is what they say, but that's really love and reverence, that you will. His ways will be your ways. You will love to read the Bible, Science and Health, Prose Works. You will love to know more about Him. You want to stay in the Father's house and find peacefulness, blessedness, joy, all good things there. And it also brings out, you know, family joys. Family, Virgin says, family blessedness comes from the Lord. To the Lord alone, we must look for it. And anything good that is in our life is a result of this holy living, putting God first. And sometimes it doesn't always happen that way. Maybe you don't get what you think you want all the time, but it will result in good, whatever happens, because that's the kind of God we have. And all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to His purpose. That is a divine law that you can count on. It'll work together for good. Whatever the trial is, you'll come out better for it.
And that kind of contentment is something that no person can ever take away from you. It's because it's strictly between you and God. And you have overcome all the human temptations to feel sorry for yourself or get mad at somebody or whatever. And so nobody can take that kind of contentment away. And it's like,
and when you have this mindset, even in the face of adversity, and you're listening and you're knowing that God is ever present, then you're getting those little angel messages that sort of carry you through. I think Mrs. Eddy said, and I paraphrase, we go over the currents of mortal mind, not through them. So you can go through something that seems really bad, and then, you know, when you're staying with God, you look back and you say, wow, I have grown so much as a result of that thing that seemed, you know, it's that wonderful statement about angels unawares. Just awesome.
Yes, you've entertained angels unawares. And if you hadn't had that experience, you wouldn't have gone up higher. You would have just stalled where you were. But only if you face the experience with God. I mean, if you mumble and grumble and get more into the human sense of things, yeah, that's no good. But when you face it with God, you will rise to greater heights. And that is an absolute guarantee.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible says that no situation is going to come to you that you're not ready to deal with. That's a paraphrase. But it's throughout the Bible, isn't it?
And it's interesting in the Spurgeon, he speaks about this Psalm 131. He said it is one of the shortest psalms to read, but one of the longest to learn. And it's a short ladder if we count the words, but yet it rises to great height, reaching from deep humility to fixed confidence. And, you know, it starts out saying that that my heart is not haughty. It's a good question to ask. Nor are mine eyes lofty. And he says, what the heart desires, the eyes look for. And where the desires run, the glances usually follow. So you go down that trail, you think you're in control of things, but you start thinking maybe you know better than God, or there's certain things you want and you're going to seek after those things. And then pretty soon your eyes start looking for whatever those things are. And pretty soon you want those things more than anything else, more than your relationship with God or with others. And you seek after that. And then you have a tremendous comeuppance.
Like our lesson this week with David.
Yes, thank you. Like the lesson, this beautiful lesson this week with David, where first he desired, then his eyes were roaming around where they shouldn't be. And you think you can control that, but he couldn't, could he? David, the one who slayed Goliath. So we're pretty arrogant if we think we can do things, let our desires and then our eyes, our glances can control, we can control it. The next thing we know, we're in pretty darn hot water. So that's why he says it's the shortest, but the one of the longest to learn. And then you behave, surely I have behaved and quieted myself. So you put down all this stuff that tries to overtake you and quieted yourself in the Lord. And then at the end, it says that he prayed for, let Israel hope in the Lord from henceforth and forever. See how lovingly a man who is weaned from self, because it goes into being weaned from self, thinks of others. David thinks of his people and loses himself in his care for Israel. So that's the progression of those three verses in that beautiful Psalm 131. Spurgeon. He says a lot of really good things.
Yes,
boy. He's good.
And I guess his church still continues. Right, Florence?
England. Yes.
Yeah, with a really good preacher, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe we should move on to another very short song. Question number four. How is unity achieved? Psalm 133, verses 1 to 3.
Psalm 133. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. It is like the precious ointment upon the head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard, that went down to the skirts of his garments, as the dew of Hermon upon the mountains of Zion.
You just put it right there. Thank you.
Blessing, even life forevermore.
Thank you.
Well, dwelling together in unity is no small task.
No.
No, because it implies more than one person being involved in it.
I think it also goes against this thought of, which is so common in organizations, not just churches, but, you know, you're part of an organization and you know the right thing to do. You just got to convince the others, right? And it's going to be your way because you know the way what you're thinking is right. So it's so easy to do, like, I know what's the best thing to do. And all you do is create dissension and disharmony and is he trying to get your way.
That's why I've had the thought that the number one person you have to protect the church from is yourself.
That's right.
It also wasn't groupthink either.
Well, that's it. That's it exactly. I mean, faced with the Pharisees asking Jesus, you know, what's the great commandment? He gave us the answer to this question. First, you love God and obey God, But then you love your neighbor as yourself. You see your neighbor as the image and likeness of God. And that is the only way you love your neighbor. And you expect your neighbor to have the mind of Christ and obey the mind of Christ. And you set yourself as an example. And you let your neighbor do what God instructs them to do and to learn whatever lessons they need to learn. And when you've got two or more people together in my name, there am I in the midst of them.
It's a tremendous lesson, because Mrs. Eddy does imply it's one of the greatest powers on earth is to dwell together in unity. And that's why, you know, the prayers of the United Thought. She says a lot of meaningful things about it. And also in the Bible, one stick you can break, a bundle you can't. There's no doubt that this is why our church remains here today, because we remained united. And Mrs. Evans, while she was here, she worked on that. And we, you know, we had to get along with each other. and we were constantly rubbing elbows. We had all kinds of things to do together. And at one point, there were a lot more people here than there are now. So, but only through that could we have achieved what we did, through the united thought, love for the brethren, and just incredibly important. And it still goes on, and to this day, our united thought. And when people come who are not right, who are ambitious, lofty ambitious, who think they want to change things or they know better, and they don't know what they don't know, as the expression goes.
but their heart is haughty.
But their heart is haughty, yeah, with lofty looks. They end up ejecting themselves. As long as the majority of people are thinking correctly and humbly and lovingly, any foreign thought, it either will be healed or it will go. And that must be, in order to have a church, a united church. Once you lose that, then you have all kinds of people and dissension, and it no longer works. I read about that last week at the roundtable, where an evangelist was talking about that, the mega churches where there is no real unity. They all just hop on the bandwagon. It's important. And until you understand things, sometimes it's better to keep quiet about it.
Quality, not.
Yes, quality, not quantity.
But it's a wonderful thing when it can be achieved, because it's a rare thing, isn't it?
Rare.
And of course, in Christian Science, it is based on the one mind. And I don't know what other church has that, or there is one mind. And yeah. Although we don't tell people what to do or how to think, we do pray about that, the one mind. And for the most part, in important issues, people come to the same conclusions.
I think one of the biggest impediments is wanting what you want. People that are insisting on having what they want, it creates so much trouble. It's the number one thing that causes trouble in people's lives. You know, instead of the humility, dear God, what do you have for me? Or what do you have for us? And I'm receptive to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it's so simple, but very powerful when it's achieved.
Yes. Shardy.
Well, Shardell. There's a wonderful article about unity in the Red Book on page 15. It's lovely. And I think that, you know, people might want to look at it sometime. Mrs. Eddy said it's all oneness, like you just said. Mm-hmm. Any departure from oneness, leaving science and accepting the evidence and testimony of the senses in direct opposition to science. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It shows you have one goal, you know, that you come selflessly to do it, to do the work for God. And God being the main focus. That's it.
Thank you.
I have a quote here in Miscellaneous Writings. If you go to page 138, she has a lot to say about unity, but I'll just read one line because it goes with our hymn that we started with. She says, quote, "I once thought that in unity was human strength, but have grown to know that human strength is weakness, that unity is divine might, giving to human power peace," end quote.
Beautiful. This is what we work for, to achieve. And as Jeremy says, where do you start? You have to begin with yourself.
Yes. You know, another thing I found along the way being here is that sometimes I would get a thought like, this is how to move forward. And then when I would present it, I realized like the inspiration I got went through and made it so that the inspiration other people got ended up leading to the right thing. And I think that's like a really important part of this. It's not that we get it right ourselves immediately. It's that we're just willing to go through that process and how it's been quite a wonderful process to go through and see that work all along the way. And yeah, just getting rid of that thought, like, I don't know, I've seen people kick themselves for not getting it right away. And there's not a need for that, you know, just be willing to go through it. It's quite a wonderful thing.
That's an excellent, excellent point, because so many people will think that the first idea that they get is right and they'll try to push it through. Mrs. Eddy admitted occasionally she would get an idea and it would lead her somewhere to the point where she would recognize that the idea was not the right idea, and she would get the right idea after going down the path that she was first given. This requires humility. It requires total humility and a selfless purpose. And we should all ask ourselves, who do I feel closest to? Who do I feel united with? And if it's not God's people, better take a deep look inside and see what your motive for living is.
Yeah, first God himself and then God's people. And that's in ways that are vain. Because when that voice starts talking to you to separate you from God's people, that's the voice that's taking you away. And it'll make everything upside down. You will trust those you shouldn't and distrust those you should. And I mean, we've seen it happen in this church. And it's usually not a good thing at all. Always, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, we're seeing it with Judas and the Chosen.
Yeah, we're seeing it with Judas and the Chosen. Those of you who have watched it starts in 4, but certainly season 5, he hears this voice going on that pulls him away. And he ends up doing the unthinkable. In an article that Carey sent on the joy of unity via Jane Carey, says, "It is impossible to feel the presence of God, divine love, and man's oneness with love while our consciousness is clouded with criticism, resentment, or fault-finding. These thoughts are not true because they came from the carnal mind, which Paul speaks of as an enmity against God. We must not accept them or give them any power, for they are robbers, which would deprive us of the joy and communion with our Father, Mother, God, and the blessedness of unity." So, and if you feel, you know, something and it needs to be spoken to, then you should. And that's in the Bible too. It's biblical. You go to the person and say, you know, I have this problem and this is what it is. And if that person does not change, then a group of people can go to that person and speak to them if it's a legitimate complaint. But you must do everything you can to help that person. And hopefully they are willing to be helped. So, but God guides you in all of these ways. But when you're just fault finding and critical and condemning without any basis, or just because you have a personal vendetta against that person, then that is extremely harmful for you and for the other person. And again, Spurgeon writes a lot on this, and it's beautiful. And something I'm not going to read it all, but he talks about the unity of family. Dwell together in unity. It's a wonderful thing. How many times do you see all these families feuding and carrying on and fighting? Yes. That's why Mrs. Evans would talk about the bloody holidays. Mm-hmm. And then about the unity of church fellowship and how important that is. So thank you, Tom.
Yes.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for everybody who joined in.
Do you want to say anything, Tom?
No, I'm good. So I just think it was a wonderful discussion, and I hope we all got a lot out of it. That's all. And thank you for everybody who joined in.
And we were talking about another
thank you so much.
Bible study right the day after Thanksgiving.
The Saturday after Thanksgiving. I think it's November 29th. And Tom is going to do something. It ushers in the holy days, the Christmas. It's a beautiful time to get together and discuss, have a Bible topic on that day. So it's the Saturday after Thanksgiving. I believe it's November 29th.
That sounds right.
Save the date.
Holy day.
What say?
I said that's a holy day.
Yes, because it's Florence's special day.
Oh, it's your special day. Oh, oh yes.
Your special day.
Very good.
We'll all remember that.
Very holy special day, yes. Yes, indeed.
Ah, sounds good.
It does. So anyone else who wanted to speak? Bruce?
I thought it was amazing to learn about Samuel Johnson. Thank you for bringing him.
Yes.
I didn't know much about him before.
No, we didn't.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you, Tom. Yes, very, very inspired.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Yes.
Thank you.
Have a happy day.